Accession number 28198, reel 3.
Is showing you a photograph of that. In the morning, the Sungiboya River ran through Teledato Estate, and when I went across the river to go to muster the following morning, I found all the tappers still standing around with the buckets and not going to work, and I asked what was the matter, and they used the peculiar expression in Tamil, which meant, "There is no room, sir." And I said, "What the devil do you mean there's no room?" And they went on to gesticulate that the trees had been blown down, and I went to the field they were talking about, and sure enough, about 25 acres of trees had been blown out, blown down, and one of which I got a photograph to send the board of directors was a big tree that had been twirled round like a corkscrew. The top was torn off and it was split right down the middle, but it hadn't come out of the ground, which I thought was far more effective way of showing the board of directors in London what had happened than trying to write a report about it. And there was another portion of the estate actually where there were no tappers working that day, where another 25 or 30 acres had been blown flat. The wind had apparently come from the north side of the estate, come down on the first lot of trees at the back, and then leapt up and come down on the next 25 acres, which was at the other side of the estate. And it hadn't disturbed my bungalow at all. I've been able quite to understand that one. Never heard anything. It occurred when I was on the Jerampadang estate, at of which the civic centre was a village called Teledato, where the district officer lived, and I had gone there, I forget the year now, I was home on leave when a bad slump in rubber occurred, and I changed the states while I was home and went out to act for the manager who was going on leave on a small portion of, became a division of Jerampadang, that was actually situated quite near this township of Rantau, and the medical officer there, who later became my wife, worked in the general hospital in the village, and I saw her first playing tennis and was introduced to her, and later in the evening there was another man, I've forgotten who it was, and myself, left in the club by ourselves when the telephone bell went. And this turned out to be Dr. Winifred Mitchell ringing up for help. She was terrified by some creature that had got into her bungalow. So we both rushed up there to see what it was, and we found it was four or five baby owls had fallen through the trapdoor in the roof and were screeching their head off in the ground. So we bravely removed the owls and became closer friends. I had always been very fond of Stilton cheese, and my mother-in-law knew it. And on this particular occasion, she sent me out, or sent us out, a whole Stilton cheese. But unfortunately, she'd gone, so I understand, to her local grocer and asked him to carry out the order, and with thoughtfulness but complete ignorance of such matters, he got this Stilton cheese, put it in a tin, one of these large tin biscuit tins, and soldered it up so as presumably to make it airtight. But of course it had done nothing of the sort, because there was air in the tin, and the cheese took, I suppose, the best part of a month to arrive, and travelling through Red Seas and other hot tropical places, when I opened it, it had just gone bad, and it was, you never smelt badness like it. It hadn't ripened. There was no blue in it. It was just stinking rotten. So, naturally, we never told Mother about it. And the only place I could think of disposing it, I had a in the unoccupied part of the estate, the back of the house, I'd had a large refuse pit dug, very deep, in which I put all the foul rubbish, and I could put earth on top of it, and I wanted to do. So I tipped this beautiful, what had been a beautiful Stilton cheese, into the pit. And at the time I had two bull terrier dogs. No, I didn't have a mongrel and a bull terrier dog, a white bull terrier. And all of a sudden there was an awful smell in the house, and I discovered to my horror that this bull, white bull terrier, had discovered this Stilton cheese and got down into the pit and wallowed in it, and his, from behind his ears to his muzzle, was just stinking rotten Stilton cheese, which of course I had to wash off and see that the Stilton cheese at the bottom of the pit was well covered. Brian was 4 or 5 years old then, I suppose, and it was the club Christmas party, which of course was organized by the ladies, and the club room, the club was a timber building, and there was a ladies room, as it was always called, and a billiard table and bar for the men, and a small dais at one end where shows were put on, if any. And the Christmas tree was on this dais, and I was down helping when I saw that the ladies were putting ordinary candles on the Christmas tree. And I suggested it was rather dangerous, because things might go on fire from the candles when they were lit, and was told to mind my own business. And so I did, and then when the Christmas festivities night was on, all the children were down on seats near the dais and waiting for Father Christmas to come in, and the candles were all lit, and it was all very cozy. And my son Brian, who was one of the smallest children, was sitting in the front row, and I suddenly thought of something, I've forgotten what it was now, that I wanted to say to him. And it was very fortunate I did, because I went round to the front and was leaning forward to speak to Brian when Father Christmas came in from a side door on the dais and walked up to the tree and put his whiskers in one of the candles, which went up in flames, his whiskers did. And fortunately I was close at hand, and I leapt up on the dais and grabbed his top of his head, which is the first thing I got, and I pulled his red cap, whiskers and cloak off onto the floor of the dais. And he was thinking of the children and went out as fast as he could through the door he came in at, so as they wouldn't be frightened. And my son Brian chuckled with glee and said, "Father Christmas all burnt up." There he was, his cap and whiskers and cloak on the floor. The Father Christmas was not badly burnt, but he'd got a shock and burnt round his cheeks a bit. So we took him home for my wife to take care of him. And as next day, I think, or the day after, was Christmas Day, we asked him to stay, and he was very distressed because he had a wife and biggish daughter in Singapore. So we asked them to come up and have Christmas dinner with us, and we had it all arranged with much difficulty. And then, to our horror, when the wife and daughter arrived to join our Christmas, usual Christmas dinner, which is the same as you have any place else in English-speaking countries, we discovered to our dismay that the wife and daughter were vegetarians. Fortunately, in the bungalow, I had a large supply of tinned vegetables available in case of emergency. But it certainly was a shock when you've arranged turkeys and plum pudding. Well, recently I saw a film, an American film, which claimed to represent the true representation of the trial of the Tiger of Malaya for war crimes in Malaya. Well, I was a prisoner of war for 3.5 years, and I have no kind thoughts for the Japanese of that era, but I've never been so disgusted at the gross unfairness of the representation of that trial, where hearsay evidence was accepted and the protests of the friends of the prisoner, as they're called in English court martials, were ignored. I have very personal reasons for making that claim, because I had a personal incident where I maintain there are only two bodies who would know the truth of whether a war crime had been committed or not, and one is God and the other is the person who is alleged to have committed the war crime. The incidents to which I refer occurred in Singapore after the Japanese had landed on the northwestern portion of the island, which is diamond shaped, and the unit I belonged to, which was the Federated Malay States Volunteer Force, were on the northeastern face of the diamond-shaped island. As I was second in command of the unit there, I was sent back to a designated area to select positions for the troops when they were withdrawn from the northern front, as the Japanese had already landed on the northwestern side. I went back to a place that was about 2 or 3 miles out of Singapore town, did my job there, saw the units from when they withdrew into their positions, and also had picked battalion headquarters. Now, battalion headquarters was in a group of commission type houses, about four rooms of four roomed houses. Each two rows were back to back, and in between them was an unmetalled road to allow traffic to go through. These were on the main road, and they were built where originally there must have been a gully crossing the main road, which had been filled in when the road was made. Now, there were the houses on the south side. The road from Singapore to Changi ran west to east, and this gully had been filled in. There were the houses on the south side, and on the left side there was a long slope, curving slope, grass covered, which led down to the water in the storm drain, which went through. And it is rather important that any listeners there may be should realize the topography. Now, what happened was my colonel had gone out someplace, and I was in sole charge of headquarters at that time and the lives of the people there, and also responsible if any action reports had come through from where our line was. Now, the first thing that occurred, on the pavement, I had picked battalion headquarters as an empty house, which was in the fourth row of the four rows of houses, and immediately in front of that line of houses there was a pile of white rice put on the pavement of the main road. Now, it wasn't just spilt rice, it was rice that had been put in a very careful and neat pyramid on the pavement. So at the time it didn't give any idea to me that I had it removed, because from an aircraft's point of view it would be a glaring signal. I then did some other business, and I had to go out on the job, and I got in my car with my driver and went out, and on the edge of the unmetalled road that went between the houses where battalion headquarters was, on the corner, I suddenly saw three banana leaves put in the form of an arrow on the diagonal, which also pointed to where battalion headquarters was, with a pile of rice on the apex of the triangle. As the volunteers, when the war started, had both Malays and Europeans in them, the Malays had all been sent back at that by that time to their own districts, and we had a large number of regular sergeant majors who were supernumerary to the unit. So I got one of my sergeant majors that I knew personally, and I knew as a regular soldier he'd obey any order given to him. I put him in one of the front row of houses and told him if he saw any person depositing piles of rice in front to shoot them, an order which I should have given him in writing, but I knew he'd obey it anyway. So I then went back to headquarters to organize things and went out again on the job I was going to do. And as I turned out to the right towards Changi, I saw a very well-dressed Malay in a very clean sarong and baju, newly ironed, walking down the right-hand side of the road from Changi to Singapore. And when he came to this grass slope on the right-hand side of the road that went down to the storm drain, he was carrying a basket in his right arm. And this is very vivid to me. He emptied a big collection of white paper straight down the green verge, straight in front of the fifth house, which was the middle one in the line of battalion headquarters. So I stopped my car, I pulled up my revolver and I cocked it and I challenged him, and I was even more amazed when I saw the mass of paper he'd tipped out. It all consisted of unused notepaper and envelopes. I questioned him in Malay as to what he was doing, and he said, oh, his Tuan had told him to throw this away. And I said, why, who was his Tuan? And to my amazement, he pulled out what the British Army know as the AB-64, which is your pay book, and he showed me one entry for a number of dollars, which I don't remember now, and he produced brand new straight settlement notes to prove that he'd got his pay, and it was exactly what was entered in his AB-64. Now this made me disbelieve him more than ever, because I don't believe at that stage he could have got brand new straight settlement notes unless it had been made by the Japanese. And to this day I do not know whether I was remiss in my duty as an officer in not shooting a traitor dead, as I feel I should have done, or whether I funked the responsibility. As it happened, I got a passing soldier to take him into the guard room of my unit and put him under close arrest. And to this day I do not know whether I should have shot him or not, and if I had shot him and later been charged as a war criminal, I denied it most rigorously, because he was a traitor to his country. Well, when we were first confined in Singapore, we were in Changi, not the Changi jail, but in the troop barracks on the eastern tip of the island. And then we were withdrawn into the town where the Japanese had continued with what was originally an army project of building storehouses, large storehouses, on some abandoned land at River Valley Road. And the troops that I was in charge of were engaged in making concrete floors for these very large buildings. And each morning, the troops concerned would go down to the site and draw from the Japanese stores their tools and bags of cement and sand and soap and stone. And the cement was in the large paper, strong paper bags that most people are aware of, and carry them to the site and then get down to the job of work for the day. On this particular day, remembering that my troops were all, the troops I was in charge of were all volunteers, Australian tin miners, rubber planters, office people from upcountry Kuala Lumpur and elsewhere, and I was only allowed as a senior officer to visit occasionally. All the troops on the site were under command of junior volunteer officers, and this particular day, when I was not there personally, one of the men who'd drawn a bag of cement to make his concrete, he was a rubber planter, called the platoon commander over, and he said, "Look here, so this stuff that I've got is cement, isn't cement, it's rock phosphate, which is used very largely for manure and on rubber plantations." And the platoon commander, who happened to be